Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Naomi Klein. Welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
I was very taken with this article you did in Harper's, Minority Deathmatch, Jews, Blacks, and the Post-Racial Presidency. What really I was taken with in this looking at Durbin and the Conference on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Tolerance, it was called, because of all the blow-up in America and the world and our public perception of this conference, which is really defined by the media in ways that most of us didn't understand, because you kind of jumped into the complexity of all of this.
I have this sort of personal obsession with that first Durban conference in 2001, because it seemed to me at the time that it was really being misrepresented in the press, even while it was going on.
And you were aware of that then?
Sorry?
You were aware of that then?
I was aware of it because I had a lot of friends who were involved in the conference, and I was following it. And in the lead-up to the conference, the debate was all about reparations, reparations, not in the sense of checks for individuals, but the idea of recognizing historical debts that the global North owes to the global South and the South within the North. And it was really a historic conference. And the significance of the conference, it seemed to me, was that it deepened the discussion about racism. I think that a lot of Western governments thought they would go to a conference about racism at the United Nations, and it would be really only dealing with the surface level discrimination. It turned into this real, in a sense, a trial for the crimes of colonialism and slavery. It made racism a lot less safe for the elites to embrace. It wasn't just, a sort of well-meaning statement being signed that everyone knew wasn't going to lead to anything. I mean, slavery was being called a crime against humanity that had legal repercussions. But once the conference got underway, almost all the Western press focused on were these incidents of anti-Semitism that took place mostly on the margins of the conference. There was some really awful, awful anti-Semitic material being circulated by a couple of NGOs. Then there was some anti-Semitic expression on the streets outside. But in terms of the conference itself, the major players in the conference, it actually had absolutely nothing to do with it. And so these really ugly incidents, and I'm not denying that they took place, they did take place, were really being used to discredit this entire historic gathering. So the reason why I have this kind of Durban obsession is because I was writing an article about that, making exactly that argument, that the whole discussion around anti-Semitism was a smokescreen, that the real significance of this conference were that the bills for colonialism were coming due, whether it was indigenous people in North America talking about land claims, whether it was landless people in Brazil talking about land reform as the solution to racism, or people in South Africa talking about the fact that there had never been any reparations for apartheid, in fact that their government was paying the debts of the colonial regime. So really, looking at the economic component of racism. So I was writing a weekly column for a newspaper, the Globe and Mail in Canada, and I was having some, this to me was such a big issue, I was having a lot of trouble fitting it into my 800-word slot. So I called my editor and I said, because sometimes when I begged and pleaded, he would give me the larger slot, which was 1,200 words. So I called him to make what was an all too frequent pitch, which was that he'd give me more words. This is very common in my life. I'm always bargaining with editors for more words. So we were talking about it, and I was trying to explain to him just how important this topic was. And he said, Naomi, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center.
Right.
I don't think I need your column this week. And hung up on me.
Whoa.
And sure enough, that was the morning of September 11th, and it's always stayed with me that the attacks derailed us from this incredibly important discussion, not out of some conspiracy, but it's a fact. I didn't write that column. I for the many years later, I wrote like so many other people about war and security and torture and all the other things and all the racial profiling and so on, all the rear guard battles that we've been fighting during the Bush years. But because that, because in a way Durbin was erased before we could even process what happened because of the September 11th attacks, the conference ended 2 days before September 11th, it was very easy to misrepresent what happened because it was never fully reported on at the time. So that's why it was so important for me to go back and talk about the importance of that first Durban conference, because President Obama's excuse for why he wasn't going to the follow-up conference in Geneva that just took place in the spring was this same misinformation about what had actually happened at the first Durban conference.
So what's interesting, there's so many aspects of this, I mean, that feed into this story that maybe now people can wrestle with it, that they couldn't then because of September 11th. But, mm-hmm. I mean, let's just start with what you said in the very beginning and work our way through some of this. I mean, the idea that this conference in Durban that has been labeled a conference that just went after Israel as a racist state, mm-hmm. and we'll get to some of that in a minute.
Yeah.
But one of the things you said was that this conference created an atmosphere where racism and being anti-racist would no longer be safe for many people in a discussion, because the language and the context and the definition of the discussion was changing because of this conference. And that was enough for many Western countries not to want to participate alone or be fearful of participating, maybe why the Bush White House, as you wrote, pulled out in the beginning before, even though they were using anti-Semitism as an excuse. So talk about that.
And I mean, I can certainly confirm that. And one of the things I did for the Harper's piece is I went back and interviewed a lot of the players in the first Durban conference, and one of them is retired Ambassador Michael Southwick, who was the head of the U.S. delegation to Durban and led the walkout on the directions of the Bush administration. And he talked to me because he agrees that this conference has been deeply unfairly maligned, and he actually didn't want to walk out in the first place. So he believed that the Bush administration should stay, but he certainly confirmed that it wasn't just the anti-Semitic incidents. That wasn't why the Bush administration walked out. In a sense, they never walked in. When it became clear that there was going to be language that was going to accuse Israel of systematic discrimination, basically he never registered. The delegation never actually registered. They tried to get this language taken out before the conference began, and when they failed to get it out before the conference began, they withdrew. But he confirmed to me that it wasn't just that there were other factors at work. One was reparations, that the Bush administration was very, very opposed to any language that could lead to having to pay reparations for slavery. That's no surprise there.
Or even the discussion
about
it.
But also just this was a preview of the unilateralism that would characterize 8 years of Bush. So, I mean, in many ways, it's hardly surprising that they didn't want to be bound by decisions made at a UN conference on racism. This administration didn't want to be bound by any form of international law. So this was just an early preview into that.
But it was also, I remember in your article, Southwick was saying that there was great dissension inside the Bush administration, that Powell did not want to withdraw, really, that he was leading that discussion, and Southwick thought that they would get that language about Israel out anyhow.
And in fact, the language about Israel did come out anyhow. Even without the U.S. and Israel there, it was taken out. The language about Israel in the Durban Declaration is very, very mild. It's nothing that Joe Biden wouldn't say. I mean, it's two-state solution. Every state has the right to security. The Holocaust must always be remembered.
Right.
So there's just been a huge amount of slander. I mean, most people, certainly most American Jews, believe that the first Durban Declaration said that Zionism is racism, and that is absolutely untrue. In fact, at the time, Shimon Peres, who was the foreign minister at the time of Israel, praised the document, the final document, as a victory for Israel and a blow for the Arab League, because all this language was taken out. So Michael Southwick and Colin Powell believed that they should stay for the whole negotiations, that the negotiations would be able to get the language that they were worried about out. and he wasn't given that leeway because more powerful people than him in the Bush administration didn't think they should be there at all, and so were happy to seize on any out, including this claim that they were so horrified by the anti-Semitic incidents that they had to walk out. And this was, of course, nonsense because the decision was made before any of this even happened.
We're talking to Naomi Klein about her report in Harper's Magazine called Bernardi Death Watch, Jews, Blacks.
Deathmatch.
What did I say? Death Watch. Excuse me. I'm thinking about the healthcare debate. Minority Deathmatch. Jews, Blacks, and Post-Racial Presidency.
I mean, it is an inflammatory headline. There's no doubt. Publications are doing pretty much anything to sell magazines these days.
Yes, they are. But that's good. Maybe people will read the article.
The print industry is in crisis. But that deathmatch, it comes out of the piece where I am talking about the ways in which Jews and African Americans have really been pitted against each other in this process, because the first Durban conference and the second Durban conference were so important to civil rights leaders, to the Congressional Black Caucus, there were almost 2,000 African Americans who attended the first Durban conference. I refer to it in the piece as a kind of a Black Woodstock.
Right.
And what I say in the piece is that what is so, I think, sad about what has happened is that it didn't have to be treated as a minority death match, where one group fights the other group to the end. A lot of African American leaders, to their credits, really tried to work with large Jewish and pro-Israel organizations to try to address the fair and real concerns about a repeat of these anti-Semitic incidents and the more inflammatory language. And unfortunately, they got nowhere. Then, no matter how many concessions were won, no matter how many changes were won, unfortunately, the word from Israel was, "We want this conference to be discredited. We want it to go down. We want a boycott." So I think there's a lot of bad feelings left by a situation that should never have been treated like a minority death match. And so that's the context of the headline. If I can make a small excuse for myself
that's fine,
and my editor.
But I mean, there is a long history that we have covered intensely here over the last 17 years of relations between the Black and the Jewish world, this is a piece of it and a very important piece of it. But I think that one of the things the article points out is that the what happens at all UN conferences is that there are the non-governmental organizations, the NGO conference that also takes place, which was very different, which is where a lot of the anti-Semitic language and anti-Israel language, anti-Zionist language, exploded from. And tell that story and how that ended up being the story rather than the story of racism and reparations and for the world to wrestle with the issue of slavery and colonialism.
Well, it's true. There were really three elements of the conference, and increasingly this is the case for any large UN conference. There's the intergovernmental conference, which produces the declaration, the document that we've been talking about. These are ambassadors, foreign ministers, sitting in a room together negotiating a text. That's the main conference. Then there is the NGO forum, where accredited NGOs have panels, protests, sort of mild protest actions. In the case of the first Durban conference, it was absolutely huge. 8,000 people were in a massive outdoor cricket stadium. So just imagine the scale of this thing. And it was a sort of, anti-racism bazaar. Like you had every group represented in the world, the Roma, the Dalits, Palestinians, everybody was there making their case. It's a little bit like the World Social Forum, that kind of a fair type of an atmosphere. And then the third element, in the case of Durban 1, were protests outside, very large protests outside, led by South African activists who were upset with their own government, their feeling that they had failed to address the deep underlying causes of racism, which was the concentration of wealth. I mean, this is an ongoing, very, very fierce debate inside South Africa because at the end of apartheid, there was a power struggle that went on about whether the African National Congress would make good on the centerpiece of their economic program, which was that in addition to everybody in South Africa getting the vote and having freedom of movement, that there would be wealth redistribution, and in particular the Freedom Charter, the centerpiece of the movement, the document at the center of the movement, said very clearly that the wealth of the country, the mines and the banks, would be nationalized, and that the wealth would then be used to build schools and electrify the townships and so on. And a decision was made not to do that, as we know. And so what happened at Durban was that for the first time you had tens of thousands of South Africans in the street voicing their grievances against the ANC, which was very, very significant because this was the ANC base. I mean, this was not sort of anti-ANC activists. These are lifelong ANC supporters who are basically saying, we are still living with racism because we are still in townships without water and electricity and holding up signs that said things like landlessness equals racism. So there was a lot going on.
And the new apartheid, the new apartheid is rich and poor.
This debate is still going on in South Africa, but you know, in many ways, it was just a very intensified version of the global debate was happening in countries that, including in the U.S., that had won the legal struggles against racism, that banned the overt manifestations of racism, but had not kind of finished the job in terms of dealing with the massive gulfs, the wealth gaps left behind by systems of institutionalized racism. And you know, that is the heart of the reparations discussion in the United States. So having the conference in South Africa was supposed to be this this feel-good symbolic gesture, like the world defeated racism in South Africa, and now they will defeat all remaining vestiges of racism around the world. And instead, it really backfired because the failure to deal with the economic component of apartheid became this kind of intense microcosm for the failure to deal with the economic legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in the United States, and mm-hmm. the failure to deal with the economic legacy of colonial regimes all over the Caribbean. So it was an extraordinary historic event, and this is another reason why I wanted to write the article, because I feel because of the timing, the historical importance of this event, and it's been written about by scholars like Manning Marable on several occasions, has gotten lost. So I just wanted to sort of pull some of these incredibly important events out of the dustbin of history, if you will.
And you did, this is a really important discussion, I think, at least in the media and for people to understand what really happened here, and I really want to explore for a few minutes how this was exploited and turned around, and the image of this conference was then manipulated in a different way by a lot of NGOs.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back to that, but I do just want to say that you know it is the reason why it is so important to talk about now, and it isn't just about just sort of setting the record straight.
Mm-hmm.
It's because this debate is at the center of the economic crisis that we're living through right now. The failure to deal with the economic legacy of slavery and Jim Crow is the reason why people needed subprime mortgages, is the reason why our economy imploded. So in my view, the discussion that was happening in Durban in 2001 has never been more relevant. And Obama's decision to avoid that discussion was terribly disappointing in this particular moment. In terms of how the conference was distorted, there's good reason for it. You know, we've been talking about what went on in terms of the discussion of colonialism and slavery, but there was some very, very important activism that took place at the first Durban conference around Palestine. And there was a strategy on the part of Palestinian NGOs led by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and Badil, the two very important Palestinian NGOs. And we have to remember the context in which this was happening, which was the Oslo talks had just collapsed. There was a great deal of fear that there was no route forward for justice and peace for Palestinians. And in fact, history has proven them right. And there was a real hope that because the Oslo talks, the U.S.-led peace talks, had collapsed, that this conference could be a forum to bring some justice for Palestinians. And a new strategy was developed by Palestinian NGOs, which is now referred to as the South African strategy. And what that strategy is to apply many of the tactics that were used against South Africa during the apartheid years, boycott, divestment, sanctions, the whole anti-apartheid struggle, this tool of nonviolent civil society pressure tactics that ultimately contributed hugely to the fall of the apartheid regime, that Palestinians could use these same tools, that civil society could get behind them around the world and essentially turn Israel into the new South Africa, looking at how its laws do discriminate against Palestinians. And you know, in the years since this argument was made in Durban, and it was made really, I think, for the first time, or certainly on a global level for the first time, now we hear people like Jimmy Carter talking about the occupied territories as a system of apartheid with roads that are only accessible for Israeli settlers and not accessible for Palestinians, a system of passes that radically restrict movement, of course, the wall, which is referred to by Palestinians as the apartheid wall. Mm-hmm. You have Bishop Archbishop Desmond Tutu also saying the similarities with the apartheid system are unmistakable. The Israeli government lives in absolute fear of this model taking off, of the South African strategy taking off. The fear is that international civil society could actually start to use these pressure tactics against Israel. And in fact, it is starting to happen through the movement called Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS. We're seeing more and more a mainstreaming of this idea. But if you want to understand why such enormous effort was put into smearing the first Durban conference and any attempt to have a follow-up conference, it is absolutely because the Israeli government and its supporters around the world identified that first Durban conference as kind of ground zero for the South Africa strategy, the South Africa strategy applied to Israel, and were determined at all costs to try to derail it. In fact, they have been successful at sabotaging these Durban conferences, these Durban follow-up conferences, but they haven't been successful in derailing the movement for boycott, divestments, and sanctions as applied to Israel. The movement really is taking off, but this is at the heart of it, I'm afraid. And the urgency that the Israeli government feels to undermine this movement, to undermine this model, is so great that they're willing to radically misrepresent facts in order to achieve their goals.
But I want to wind my way back to why, before we conclude, to why this conference is so important and where this conversation you think goes from here, and the importance of it for the world to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. But what struck me in reading this article about the NGOs that were created, like UN Watch and NGO Monitor, both of which I was familiar with, and the people who created them, was the similarity between the kind of disinformation around healthcare and all the other issues we're seeing in America, mm-hmm, by Fox and other right wing news outlets. It's very similar.
And it just feels like, in a sense, we're living in the era of the smear, but mm-hmm, the bullying tactic of just anything goes. You can just repeat these untruths over and over and over again until they take on a life of their own. And that's what happened with Durban. I mean, systematically, if you do a search, you see that the word Durban and the word hate fest are appear in the same article thousands and thousands and thousands of times. This was the key talking point. Associate the first Durban conference with a pogrom, a hate fest.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there were incidents, but it was by no means a hate fest. And more than that, there were some extraordinary acts of principled solidarity. When these incidents took place, you had immediate condemnation from civil rights leaders in the United States holding press conferences, disassociating themselves, condemning the statements outright. Mary Robinson, who was the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, got so passionate she held up this anti-Semitic material and said, "Today I am a Jew." It was, and all of this is erased from the history. So not only is it smeared as having been this horrific hate fest when the world turned against Israel, but these very important acts of solidarity, of principled solidarity, are treated as if they never happened. You know, I'm Jewish, and that's, you know, I feel very passionately that this is just the wrong way for my community to behave.
Amen. I am too, and I understand.
It sends a terrible message.
Yes. And you write also eloquently about what happened when Ahmadinejad came, to the second conference, and why he was in Geneva, and why he was allowed to have such a prominent role, and how that also lent itself to the destruction of the idea of the original conference.
Yeah, I mean, it was unfortunate, but it was all connected, because at the first Durban conference, I think, what did I say? I think 16 heads of state.
Yes.
Attended the
right.
First Durban conference, because it was such an important gathering.
15 heads of state, you said in the article. 15.
15, right. Okay.
Yeah, right,
the
yeah.
article's right. It was
right.
Fact-checked by the, by Harper. But by the time the follow-up conference rolled around last spring, this campaign of misinformation, this smear campaign, had been so successful that many governments had announced that they were boycotting, and the governments that decided to attend sent very, very low-level delegations. Usually they just sent the ambassador they already had in Geneva rather than a foreign minister or a head of state. So you had this vacuum that was created very deliberately by this misinformation campaign. And who announces they'd like to come but Ahmadinejad, at the time he was in full campaign mode. This was just a few weeks before those discredited elections in Iran. And so he rolled up, and UN protocol is that the order of speakers goes according to rank. UN is a very hierarchical organization that is ruled by protocol. So heads of state speak first, then ministers, then ambassadors, then the riffraff. It's very, very clear. So the only head of state who shows up is Ahmadinejad, which means not only does he speak, but he speaks very early on in the conference agenda. And the speech that he gave was not addressed to the delegates in the room. It was addressed to voters back in Iran. And it was all about getting the clip of him standing up to the big bad Zionists in the United States. And, you know, he did that. And then the European Union delegates all did their best Winston Churchill impersonation and walked out in protest. They were standing up to the new Hitler in their imaginations. And a group of French students in a coordinated, pre-planned action put on clown wigs and clown noses and screamed, "This is a charade, this is a joke," and got hauled out by security. So it was an absolute circus, and that was the only piece of news out of that conference that actually most people saw. A friend of mine texted me out. I was in the room at the time. She texted me, watching it at home in the United States, all these European Union delegates walking out in protest. She said, "It looks like a fire drill." But yeah, I mean, I think that it was unfortunate for the United Nations. It was unfortunate for the gathering that this is all people heard. And then it was immediately seized on by these pro-Israel groups who had been working for years to discredit the conference, to say, "Look, see, it really is a hate fest. It really is a pogrom." But, you know, this is the United Nations. For God's sake, this kind of stuff happens all the time. You know, Hugo Chavez stands up and says Bush is the devil. You know, Colin Powell stands up and says, "Here are Iraq's weapons of mass destruction." You know, stuff happens at the UN.
Right.
You can't control heads of state. And the UN doesn't have actually the power to even try.
I'd like to bring this conversation in its close to kind of around the four people you talked about at the end of your article, because I think that it kind of it talks to me about how where this is in America, what the importance is, and where it might take us. And I'm talking about, you're writing about Roger Wareham, you're writing about John Powell, Juan Santos, and Moses Williams. If you could just talk about those four men, why they became part of your story, and what they have to say about where this all is at the moment.
Absolutely. Well, Roger Wareham is a very important figure in the reparations movement in the United States. He's an attorney who has tried to prosecute some corporations for profiting from slavery and sued them for reparations. And I met with him a few times during the conference. He spoke at parallel events. And what was interesting in my conversation with Roger, the last one I had on the last day of the conference, is that all he wanted to talk about was the bailout, what was the bailout of Wall Street, because it seemed to him that here we're in this situation where we have just seen how the U.S. government can spend a huge amount of money to bail out corporations when they get themselves into trouble. And his argument was, if they can find the money for AIG, they can find the money for African Americans. It struck me that that the current economic crisis and the response to the economic crisis was an extraordinary opportunity for the people who had been making the arguments in favor of reparations. And in my opinion, it really doesn't matter whether it's called reparations or called something else. I think there's a strong argument to be made that the word reparations has now been so effectively smeared, and people have a picture in their mind of what it is that is so different than what it actually is. People think it's checks in the mail, that it might be better to use another word, like repair or real repair, something like that. But what's striking about the economic crisis is that the biggest problem with the argument around the right to reparations for slavery and Jim Crow is that white Americans immediately feel like something is being taken from them and given to someone else. And as we see, you know, that in the imagination of many people in the United States who listen to Limbaugh and watch Glenn Beck, they think that that's actually what Obama is trying to do with health care and everything anyway. But it struck me that because you have all this new money out there, so we aren't talking about redistributing the current budget, but we're talking about injecting huge amounts of new money into the economy, like this $700 billion stimulus program. So, what could be a big idea for that stimulus program? And that's where John Powell comes in, because he has been working at the Kirkland Institute on a vision for how to stimulate the U.S. economy that addresses inequality, that systematically addresses inequality, particularly inequality as it breaks down along ethnic lines. This is his area of study, and he's got a fantastic research team looking at this. So what they've been looking at is what would the specific policies be that stimulated the economy but closed the gap, closed the race wealth divide, as it's often called. And they have a series of ideas that say, you know, that for instance, in the current stimulus program, you have a huge amount going into highway repair and highway construction. And you have very, very little going into public transit. If you had a program of real repair, of real recovery, that addressed the inequality that is actually at the root of the crisis, because let's remember the root of the crisis are the subprime mortgages, which were only needed because of the massive inequality in net wealth, dividing particularly communities of color and the average white community, not everybody, but the average white family versus the average black family or the average Latino family. So that's where John Powell comes in, because I actually think he has produced some amazing research that in an ideal world would be adopted by the Obama administration, and their next stimulus program could have a big idea. You know, the first stimulus program is a sort of a mishmash. It doesn't really deeply address any of the problems it sort of nibbles around, not the energy crisis, you know, not the unemployment crisis. But what if there was a stimulus program that said, we are going to use this stimulus to address the deep underlying causes of inequality in this country? I think people would be inspired by that. And this is Obama's problem, right? Is that he's going to enrage a sector of this country just by his mere existence. The problem is he's not inspiring his base to rally in defense of his ideas, because, you know, if we look at healthcare, if we look at the stimulus program, they are so compromised and so flawed that they don't inspire us. And Juan Santos is, I quote him in the piece. He's a makes me sad to talk about him, because he died a few months ago. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer and Latino activist, and died quite suddenly. I was unaware that he was ill, but he wrote up until his death, and he wrote some of the most astute, honest analysis of his concerns about Barack Obama during the campaign.
His words are so powerful.
And one of his most circulated essays was called "Our Silence Running for President." And it was a challenge to the people who were saying that, sure, Obama's not talking about race during the campaign, but that's just what he has to do to win As soon as he becomes president, he's going to talk about race. He's going to address these issues. And Juan Santos said, "This is not a strategy. This is what we can expect from him as president." And he talked about how the silence around race was racism itself. Anyway, I can't do it justice, but people should Google Juan Santos and our silence running for president, because it's a brilliant, brilliant piece of writing. And Moses Williams, on my last day of the conference, I got on the streetcar. You reach the Palais de Nation in Geneva on the streetcar at the top of a hill. And it was the end of the conference, and I was on the streetcar, and the person in front of me was an elderly African-American man with gray specks in his beard, and he was reading a policy paper on reparations. Mm-hmm. So I assumed he was coming from the conference, and I asked him what he thought of it. And he told me that he was actually wearing a Barack Obama watch, which was also interesting. But he said that he had hoped that the first Durban conference was going to be a turning point for humankind, that we were finally going to talk about what we needed to be talking about. But then September 11th happened, and the conversation changed. And he said even when September 11th happened, he imagined that the attacks themselves could be an opening, because there was so much goodwill in the world that maybe the Bush administration could use that opening to have this real conversation. But he said, well, of course they didn't do that. And then he said he imagined that when Barack Obama was elected president, that this would be the moment, this would be the opportunity mm-hmm. to finally talk about justice and these historical debts. And he said now he realized that that wasn't going to happen. So all that means is that we can't be relying on any of these leaders anymore, and that everybody who's here has to take this message, he said, to the highways and the byways.
And he's right. Exactly what people have to do. So in conclusion, tell me what you're left with. I mean, in terms of where you think this might be able to go and how this conversation might be able to take be heard in a large way, and that how it might fuel maybe something from the bottom up to push this agenda since Obama has been elected.
Yeah. Well, you know, my feeling is the conversation that took place in Durban in 2001 is the conversation of our lives. We have to have this conversation. And it's, you know, to me, one of the great tragedies of September 11th is that it interrupted it, it derailed it. The irrelevance of it has just never been more important. And the way what disturbs me is seeing the internalization of racism in the context of Obama. You have all of these intellectual civil rights leaders in the United States who were vocal on these issues in 2001, but I think have accepted that talking overtly about race is a liability to Obama, right? So what I'm seeing is a huge amount of self-censorship going on, because I know that people, that many people believe that this is important, that this is the issue of their hearts, but there's this sense of we have to stay quiet. We can't talk about these things that sound so radical, because everybody's imagining how they're going to be twisted and turned on Fox News and be used against Obama. My feeling in this moment is look at what's happening on Fox News with the Tea Parties, on Rush Limbaugh, with Obama saying absolutely nothing and doing next to nothing when it comes to addressing the race-wealth divide. I mean, this economic crisis has only deepened the divide, and it is a policy of the Obama administration not to adopt any policies that specifically address the race-wealth divide. They want race-neutral policies. So he's getting the backlash anyway, and frankly, I don't see how it can be any worse. I mean, if he's Hitler, Karl Marx, and Malcolm X all in one, okay? What, they haven't left anything in the locker room, right? I mean, what worse can they call him, right? So I just feel we have to get back to the issues. We have to talk about our passions and inspire people again, because this strategy of staying quiet, being tongue-tied, censoring ourselves isn't working.
Naomi Klein, it has been a pleasure to talk to you once again. Thank you so much for the work you do and for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.